This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
I think what has to happen is Democrats have to win the White House and both houses of Congress before any kind of serious action can be taken on climate change. But I want to add, though, that gaining ground on the state level actually could make a huge difference. You're seeing some of these states do really significant and innovative stuff on climate change. And I just want to reiterate again for people that while it does look fairly bleak on the federal level, vote in state elections. That's how things can change.
It's election season. To say that the political atmosphere is polarized understates the wormhole into which the U.S. has fallen. We have a president who tells easily disprovable lies without compunction, and a party of elected officials who line up behind him, drafting off his autocratic slipstream. This week's guest on Sea Change Radio is Greg Sargent, longtime opinion writer for The Washington Post and author of the popular blog The Plumline. His new book is An Uncivil War, Taking Back Our Democracy in an Age of Trumpian Disinformation and Thunderdome Politics. We discuss the mess that's the state of this country's politics, try to understand one party's justification for voter suppression tactics, and examine the role of the media in shaping our opinions. Then we dig into the Sea Change Radio archives to hear from political advisors Becky Bond and Zach Exley, who remind us of the many things we can all do to pitch in as the election nears. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Greg Sargent. He's the author of the Washington Post's Plumline, and his new book is called An Uncivil War. Greg, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks for having me on.
I've been a big fan of yours for over a decade and read you back when you were on Talking Points Memo.
Yes, the great old days.
So I've read you online for years, and now I finally get a chance to read you in hardcover. An Uncivil War, Taking Back Our Democracy in an Age of Trumpian Disinformation and Thunderdome Politics. Explain the challenges of trying to write a book which is essentially a snapshot in time, which I think may be yesterday's news in a few months. Things are constantly changing. How do you approach a project like this, Greg?
Well, people who write for the internet for a living learn to hit moving targets. It's a complicated endeavor, and it's hard a lot of the time, and unfortunately you miss a lot of the time. What you're talking about is a real peril. You sometimes shoot and the events have passed you by. But in this case, what I thought was, we're heading into an election. Probably most of these pathologies in our politics will show themselves in the election. So what I can do is just lay out the backstory of a bunch of them, and that'll be relevant as we head into an election and even after the election, and then talk about where things are going in the event that Democrats win or in the event that they don't, because a lot of the challenges, I think, remain the same, which is a key theme of the book. Even if Democrats win, they can't get complacent. And I'm talking about large-D Democrats and small-D Democrats, people who want to revitalize our political system but don't think of themselves as partisans. If Democrats take back the House, things will get a lot better. We'll get oversight of this administration that we didn't have for the last 2 years or a little less. But there's a real danger that all this kind of pro-democracy energy that has been unleashed by Trump's presence could dissipate, and who knows what happens 2 years later. I argue that we've got to stay focused. We can't think that just a Democratic victory means all these things are resolved. They're not. They're going to continue.
And one of the issues that sounds like it's going to continue from reading the book is voter suppression activities. Voting has become, for better or for worse, a partisan issue, which is something I never thought I would utter. How do you see that moving forward 4, 5, 6 years from now, past the age of Trump?
Well, I think there are negative possibilities and there are positive possibilities. Unfortunately, I think the conservative majority on the Supreme Court will be a lot less likely to strike down voter suppression efforts going forward, no matter how bad they get. So that's the negative. And I think Republicans will continue to do this, particularly if they win in Georgia after what they're doing there and in North Dakota after what they're doing there. They'll just learn once again that these things work. On the positive side, though, I think that you could see improvements. If Democrats are able to win a number of governor's mansions across the country, which it looks like they're going to, they're going to be able to force much fairer redistricting maps in the next decade, because they, in many states, governors have the power to veto maps. And so getting Democrats a seat at the table could ultimately result in a much less gerrymandered House map for another 10 years. So I would strongly urge any of your listeners who live in states with contested governor's races to vote. You know, your vote now could really mean something for our democracy going forward for a long time.
You sketch out the alternative viewpoint very effectively, I think, in An Uncivil War, where you summarize the Republican viewpoint during this voter suppression era as they don't think they're playing on a level playing field. They think that the Democrats over the last 50 years have pretty much bought the votes of the more vulnerable classes in American society. And so they've just bribed the lower classes through welfare and Social Security and Medicare. The Republicans who believe that voter suppression is warranted because that's the only way they can get a level playing field. Is that an accurate portrayal?
Yeah, and I'm glad you brought that up, because one of my favorite interviews for the book was done with a Republican pollster who discussed this viewpoint among his own side's voters with great candor, I thought. He's a prominent Republican pollster. He worked for Marco Rubio. He's quoted by name in the book. And what he says is essentially what you said, that a lot of and this is based on his research with Republican primary voters and Republican voters for many years, polling and focus groups. And what he told me is that a lot of these voters are deeply convinced that there's a shady alliance between non-whites and, in some cases, illegal immigrant voters and Democrats, in which Democrats essentially buy them with social services and social spending. And they've got, as this Republican pollster said, Democrats have their hooks into these people. So these voters think, Republican voters think, oh, it's not a fair fight. They've already rigged it against us. So then, once you're at that point, then you are willing to suppress the vote to make it to push back. And so I think we can't take that to the bank as a critique, because it makes it sound as if Republicans are only being responsive in suppressing the vote, when in some cases they're clearly acting proactively to rig the system for themselves, not in response to any real sort of sentiment like that. But it is interesting that a lot of Republican voters do apparently really believe this.
No, I thought it was a really insightful comment from the pollster, in that we often just assume that the other side is wrong or bad, but empathy is the best way to really understand and make headway. It's the best way to govern, ultimately, is through compromise,
right.
and understanding all perspectives.
I would agree.
Greg, one of the things that I think Democrats have had difficulty pushing back on over the last 40, 50 years, and I think larger media outlets like the Washington Post have had difficulty grappling with, is the big lie that Republicans have set forth in terms of magical thinking, that if we cut taxes and spend until the cows come home on military, the economy will be vibrant and everyone will benefit. This is a very difficult trope for a Democratic politician to fight back against, because it's very alluring for a voter. I don't think the media has done a great job in tackling this. And the reason I bring this up is because I think the Washington Post has done a great job over the last 2 years chronicling the lies of the Trump administration. Glenn Kessler, your colleague in particular, has done yeoman's work trying to write them all down, and they're calling lies lies. They're not calling them untruths or prevarications, etc. But for a journalist working for a big paper, I think that's the underlying theme that has propelled republicanism since the era of Nixon. How do you tackle that?
Well, it's interesting what you're seeing right now, because you're seeing both recognition on the media's part that they've gotten this wrong, but still, at the same time, I think maybe not quite enough of a recognition. So right now, after Republicans shut down the government to block spending, or at least tried to force a debt ceiling brinkmanship fight to do that, all of a sudden they just cut taxes for corporations and lavish that in a way that lavishes huge benefits on the wealthy, and is creating huge deficits going forward. And so the media is many mainstream media commentators who treated Paul Ryan as a serious person for a long time,
right,
because he would get up there with a pointer and rolled up sleeves and say he was deeply concerned about the deficit. Many people who did that are figuring out, okay, well, we got taken. And so they're at least now calling out this kind of sham deficit flim-flammery, as you were. But even so, it doesn't strike me as strong enough, because they're still sort of saying, oh, Republicans are being hypocrites, right? But it's not really hypocrisy. What it is Republicans scream about deficits in order to cut the spending they don't like, right? And so, and they're happy to produce deficits if it's accompanied by their own policy ends. That's the thing that they need to really recognize, right? The deficit concern, it isn't just hypocrisy. It's worse than that.
Right. And over the last 6 months, I've seen a lot of pundits on the right say Ronald Reagan said that deficits don't matter, and so as long as the economy's booming and the Dow's up, all's well. So they go back to that trope.
Right, that's true. I think that's a key point. They always have some way of justifying the production of deficits on their own watch, and then the screaming of it on Democrats' watch.
So drawn to the overthrow, just drift away, turn out the light. Sure as you're born, you be all right. November 9, my country died. Here we go again, say I got mine.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Greg Sargent from The Washington Post. His latest book is An Uncivil War. So this is a critical election. What does it mean for people who care about the environment, for the climate change movement? How big an impact will November 6th have in your estimation, Greg?
I think, unfortunately, I think we have to be a little bit pessimistic about that. I mean, because Trump is still going to control the White House. He'll be in a position to do all sorts of executive damage on that front. I suppose it's possible that you could see with a Democratic House some vigorous oversight of Trump's environmental agenda. I would hope that we would get a much closer look at how some of these decisions have been made. It seems to me that we've seen pretty clear reporting indicating that they're really suppressing data that shows that they shouldn't be doing what they're doing on environmental matters. And so I'm hopeful that robust oversight from a Democratic House could ferret some of that stuff out. But I don't know beyond that what it could mean. I think what has to happen is Democrats have to win the White House and both houses of Congress before any kind of serious action can be taken on climate change. But I want to add, though, that gaining ground on the state level actually could make a huge difference. You're seeing some of these states do really significant and innovative stuff on climate change. And I just want to reiterate again for people that while it does look fairly bleak on the federal level, vote in state elections. You that's how things can change.
Look at California.
Right.
It's the fifth largest economy in the world, so it's not nothing when Jerry Brown comes up with very aggressive climate change fighting policies.
Yeah, it's important stuff, and I think that's going to be the arena for a lot of progressive change going forward.
Getting back to media coverage, and somebody who's deep in it yourself, the era of false equivalency. I even noticed it a little bit in your book, not that you did it as much as the flap of the book. So the cover blurbs talk about how Democrats are to blame as well, and in a provocative take. And,
right.
And then when I read it, it was more like a page of, yes, the Democrats have done away with the filibuster, been a little uncompromising in terms of tax policies, etc. But then you go into saying it's by far and away the blame lies at the feet of Republicans and the conservative wing in terms of where our politics have taken us today. Not just Donald Trump, but you say that the conservative movement is largely to blame. But I couldn't help but think somebody thought that it was provocative to put that as the blurb, and that whataboutism, for lack of a better term, still sells. Do you find that's the case? And what's the challenge that you have in fighting that? You have to always come up as fair and balanced in this new era of Fox.
Yeah, and what makes it particularly distressing is that a lot of the right-wing attacks on the press for being supposedly biased against them are really in just total bad faith. It's not like they're not making real arguments. They're essentially trying to game the refs openly. And because there's a lot of it has to do with the major news organizations' business models and stuff. But they really can't afford to have that whole audience out there believe that they're biased, although it's kind of hopeless. They already do believe it. And so what ends up happening is you often see major news organizations and commentators and reporters kind of chasing after conservative approval, which is never going to come, ever, right?
Right.
Conservatives are never going to stop saying that they're biased against them, because that's the whole point, is to get them to chase. The conservatives want reporters to chase after them and game their coverage to in their direction. I wouldn't say that. That's not necessarily true across the board, by the way. Some are operating in much more bad faith than others. I want to stress that. Some of them, I think, can be reached some of them would kind of agree that there's bad faith on their side. But anyway, it's a seriously wicked problem, because whenever the left or liberals criticize the press, it seems like they take it less seriously a lot of the time than they do the right-wing criticism, yet a lot of the right-wing criticism isn't actually sincere. So it doubles the sort of sense in which this is all unbalanced.
Yes, it reminds me of this quote. I don't know where it originally comes from, but it addresses journalists directly. It says, if someone says it's raining and another says it's dry, it's not your job to quote them both. Your job is to look out the window and find out which is true.
Yeah, pretty much. I think that's right. And the side that's deliberately lying doesn't deserve to be taken seriously.
And the Washington Post has done a great job of pushing back. David Fahrenholt has exposed the corruption of the Trump Foundation through Pulitzer Prize-winning research. You're doing terrific work. We already mentioned Glenn Kessler. And yet, the Washington Post has been vilified by the right wing, and that's a huge portion of potential readership. How do you grapple with that on a business level? What kind of pushback do you get from your bosses?
Oh, none at all. I'm free to say whatever I want here, and you know, the Post opinion section is doing fantastic work, I have to say, and I don't say that just because I'm a member of it.
No, I agree.
A ton of great stuff. You know, I think. By and large, the paper, in a very broad sense, both the news side and the opinion side, are not letting these outside voices intrude on their values, which journalistic values, I mean. And I think that's a positive thing.
The reason I ask is you come from a long tradition of important journalism. What would have happened if Woodward and Bernstein had been exposing Watergate today?
Well, I don't know, but actually that kind of gets to another thing that's worth talking about in this whole context. Trump is going to benefit from something that Nixon never had. So if we presume that at some point there could be a very serious public battle between Trump and Mueller, like even a worse one than what we're seeing now.
Right.
For instance, if Mueller finds serious misconduct, I don't say criminality, but just even misconduct, like obstruction of justice that he doesn't charge him with. But if Mueller finds that, then Congress has to debate what to do about it. Trump has this tremendously powerful media apparatus, a propaganda apparatus behind him, echoing his claims and attacking the rest of the press as hostile to Trump and as essentially making things up about Trump that Nixon never had. Nixon never had an apparatus like that, and I don't think we know what's going to happen as a result of this difference.
The book is called An Uncivil War, Greg Sargent. Greg, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you so much.
Next on Sea Change Radio, let's take a listen to last year's interview with Becky Bond and Zach Exley. This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Becky Bond and Zach Exley. They're former senior advisors from the Bernie Sanders campaign. And their latest book is Roadmap for Revolutionaries. So somebody's driving in a car right now, and they're ready to jump back into the game and do something to make a positive change for the environment or any other political issue that they're passionate about. What would you recommend they do?
Again, I feel like sort of people might be a little disappointed with this answer, but I really think that we need to build power to take power, and I think there's going to be a lot of protests for the next 4 years, and you know, it's always good for people to go out and get involved, but we actually need to win elections and take power. Now, I know that a lot of people,
are they mutually exclusive?
No, they're not mutually exclusive, but what we need to do is stand up on a program that actually is going to be fantastic for the American people and that 100% embraces and does not back away from our shared vision of America as a multiracial, multiethnic place, right? And that totally says no to racism, xenophobia, and misogyny, right? And so, you know, people are just used to thinking that, oh, okay, you want to talk about elections. The way we're going to win is we're going to have to, you know, not say anything, you know, that might anger some people whose minds are primarily organized around racism and a fear or hatred of immigrants, right? And that's kind of, you know, what we've seen in a lot of Democratic politicians for a long time. So then, of course, this guy who comes out and Trump, who doesn't worry for 1 minute about offending people who disagree with him, and instead mobilizes his base. And his base is tiny. But because on the Democratic side, the vision has gotten so small that, you know, Trump was able to kind of sucker punch the establishment, you know, with the way our electoral colleges laid out, and he was able to flip just a handful of counties in a few Rust Belt states, and that's what it took to get him in there. But then, on the other hand, we need to think about how he shouldn't have had any chance at all because he was so out there and so crazy and just doing so many things to sabotage his campaign every single day. And so many people that would have liked to vote for him didn't. So we need to build a vision around that's big and that calls people to action to actually transform this country.
So do you think it'll be harder or easier to activate people when they have somebody at the top who doesn't believe in some fundamental truths like climate change?
What I find hard to understand is why President Obama, you know, who I saw speak in person in 2006, and he said to fight climate change, we need economic mobilization on the scale of World War II, which that was spending half of our GDP to completely build a new economy for several years, right? And he said, that's what we need, guys. That's what we need to do. This is before he was running for president. And then when he becomes president, and he's got a Democratic Congress when he became president, and yet he did not go to the people. If I think Obama's the irrational one, actually, because Trump is behaving very rationally. He's got investments in these pipelines and in these oil companies, and all of his friends do. So they're behaving very rationally when they oppose, doing anything against to change the economy around the environment. If only Obama had followed some, big organizing practices and had gone to the American people, like Trump is doing now for his agenda. And if, whereas Trump's agenda appeal, of deporting 11 million people and whatnot, appeals to a small fringe, those are the folks that really get excited about his agenda. But just imagine if Obama had gone to the people and said, hey, not only are we going to create 100 million amazing jobs by, spending the next several years totally rebooting our economy, but we're also going to transform our energy economy so that we've got basically no carbon emissions and have a really clean, green economy. People would have gotten so fired up about that.
Well, I think that's right, but I'm gonna sort of disagree with just even comparing President Obama to President Trump when it comes to climate. And I wanna say that there is a lot that that people who want to protect the climate can do even during a Trump administration. And part of that is building on the success of being able to block and slow down the Keystone XL pipeline and also the Dakota Access Pipeline, is that, the demand for drilling more fossil fuels, that's going to depend on being able to export this stuff. And so the extent to which states and local PUCs control export facilities, the extent to which activists who are blocking pipelines every inch of the way as they're built can make it more expensive and make it take more time to put this infrastructure in place, there is a role for individuals, especially individuals working together in their communities where this infrastructure is going in, to slow down or stop any progress towards taking more fossil fuels out of the ground that the Trump administration will be able to accomplish. So I think it's a dark time, obviously, and there was a bigger gap between, even though I wasn't happy with Clinton's environmental agenda, there was a bigger gap between Trump and Clinton than any two nominees for president, in my lifetime. But there's still things that activists can do. In addition to that is, trying to elect a new Congress in 2018 and a new president in 2020 so that we can get back to what Zach is saying.
Becky Bond and Zach Exley. Becky, Zach, thanks so much for being my guests on Sea Change Radio.
Thanks, Alex.
Thanks.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Samford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Freddie Hubbard and Fog Swamp. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.